the Zionist regime and its allies to end the occupation and give Palestinians the right to self-determination if they are serious in their condemnation that the Israeli regime's role as the occupying power is illegal. The world community also stands to win if it triggers the relevant international legal processes to stop construction of illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. After all, this is also what the International Court of Justice regarding the legality of the occupation and settlements has said. The court is absolutely clear that the Israeli regime settlements expansion as well as wall on and through the occupied Palestinian territory are condemnable and contrary to international law.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everybody. Saeed Bruza here, our top story. We start here in the UK. A legal case to determine whether Shamima Begum, the British woman who left London as a teenager to join Daesh and marry a member of the Takfiri group, is allowed to return to the UK, has reached the Supreme Court. The government has mounted a legal challenge to block the return of the British-born woman, arguing she poses a terror threat because she most likely had weapons training and has become desensitized to violence. In 2018, then Home Secretary Sajid Javid stripped her of her citizenship in violation of international law. Campaigners believe British-born criminals who commit crimes abroad are still the responsibility of Britain and should be prosecuted on British soil. Begum was discovered 9 months pregnant in a Syrian refugee camp in February 2019 and has since been battling for the right to return to the UK. Charles Shoebridge is a security analyst joining me now to talk about that story. It's good to have you on. A number of fighters have returned to the UK. Why has this case been made an example of?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And of course, that is a key point that I'm sure will be argued by those representing Shamima Begum in the Supreme Court. The fact is, by the briefings of the British government to the media, and off-record briefings by the security services have confirmed again and again that upwards of 50% of people who went off to join Daesh in the Syrian conflict from the United Kingdom have actually returned to the UK and have done so without much in the way of legal impediment. And we're talking about not just wives and children, but we're talking about the actual fighters themselves, which of course Shamima Begum has not claimed to be, and nor has anybody so far claimed that she was actually produced any evidence that she was involved in this, although she may well have been. So you've got a situation where the fighters themselves, the people that carried out so many human rights abuses, war crimes, atrocities in Syria, have been allowed back largely to the United Kingdom, and yet Begum herself has not been. And probably this is because the Home Secretary at the time decided to make an example of her because she was in the media. She perhaps foolishly, from her perspective in retrospect, gave an interview to the Times newspaper where she said that effectively that she in a way justified her position there. And of course that got the anger of the British government and the British media involved, and therefore now it's very difficult for the government to back out of the corner it's painted itself into when it said that she would not be allowed back to the UK, whereas in fact many people in her position have been allowed back.
You used the word foolishly to describe what she did, the interview she did. The government here, the issue of age, the fact that she was very young when she made that decision to go off to Syria, the government here says that her age should not be a factor. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you're right, and I say foolish in respect of the fact she is just about, and even when she gave the interview with the British media, is effectively a child, notwithstanding that the situation she's in. That doesn't excuse what she's done, but it does provide some mitigation. And when you think about the criminal justice system in the UK, and indeed in many other parts of the world, probably most parts of the world, age is a mitigating factor. Also, it's worth noting, I think, that very many other countries, for example, Russia, have long taken back certainly the children of those fighters, that those people that went from their own countries to fight in Syria. And there's an example has been made, for example, by other countries, whereby those that actually didn't take part in fighting should be allowed to return. And indeed, there isn't much in the way of example where people who have actually been allowed to return have carried out terrorist attacks, whereas, of course, many of those that actually were fighters, or some of those that were fighters themselves, when they've returned, as opposed to the wives and children, they have carried out attacks in the past. None of this is to excuse Begum's case. I mean, she, notwithstanding that she was a child when she went out there, she, I think, knew what she was doing. That was clear in this case. But nonetheless, it is a mitigating factor. And it's also, as your question suggests, it provides a basis of inconsistent treatment. The fact that so many others who actually appear to have carried out appalling atrocities on Syrian soil have been allowed to return.
One very quick question and a very quick answer. If there were to be a hearing, considering this could be politically damaging to the government, do you think there will be an entirely objective hearing?
I think the objective hearing in the courts is quite possible, and we may get an outcome here that is favourable to Begum in this case. And of course, even if the court rules against the government, I think the government in the UK, for domestic political reasons, would be happy with that. It could say, we did our best, and they will blame the courts, which they will then use as further ammunition to reform the courts and perhaps appoint their own judges in due course, because that's the direction of travel that we see in a lot of what the government in the UK is currently doing.
Charles Shoebridge, security analyst. Thank you very much. Moving on. The World Health Organization has hailed the significant breakthroughs in the development of the COVID-19 vaccine with positive news from trials bringing real hopes of an end to national lockdowns around the world. In the UK, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced he hoped almost all Britons at high risk from COVID would be vaccinated by April. Turkey's health minister says his country will be purchasing 20 million doses of the vaccine from China's Sinovac biotech after the vaccine showed success by triggering quick immune responses in mid-stage trials. Earlier today, Russian developers of the Sputnik V vaccine revealed their drug is over 95% effective. This just days after Moscow said it would be charging less for its Sputnik V vaccine than some of its Western rivals. Spain's King Felipe VI has begun 10 days of quarantine after coming into contact with a person who tested positive for coronavirus. Palace sources say the 52-year-old king was in close contact with the individual on Sunday, but gave no further details. On Monday, the monarch chaired a scientific meeting in Madrid. Spain has recorded nearly 1.6 million cases and more than 43,000 deaths since the pandemic began, the second highest toll in Western Europe after France. Starting this segment with a story we've been covering that concerns former British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. And I'm going to let Ahmed Caballo bring us up to speed. And Ahmed, a demand for an apology yet again.
Yes, so many are describing this as a civil war within the Labour Party. The current leader of the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, seems to want to dismiss and dismantle the legacy of his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn. And that's because many people see Keir Starmer as the establishment man, somebody that's not going to rock the boat. Or Jeremy Corbyn was very much trying to rock the boat and change the very nature of Britain's foreign policy, of its domestic policy, in the interest of the many rather than the few, was the tagline. Now, Jeremy Corbyn has been accused of anti-Semitism by his detractors, but Corbyn's supporters and his allies argue that supporting Palestine does not mean you're anti-Semitic, and the only reason they called him anti-Semitic was to dismantle his program, dismantle his legacy, and now the Labour chief whip is demanding an apology for Jeremy Corbyn for stating that the anti-Semitism case against members, against those who support Corbyn, was politically motivated. Now, Michael Walker has found an interesting tweet. He says, "I've unearthed a clip of another crank claiming the attacks for Jeremy Corbyn were politically motivated. I assume Labour's whip will be demanding a full and swift apology from Keir Starmer."
Well, look, the attacks on Jeremy Corbyn in that election we've just had were terrible, and they came back at us on the door. They vilified him, and they knew what they were doing, and they knew why they were doing it. And they do it to every Labour leader, and they know why they're doing it. Now, we've just lost the election, so we better prepare for the next one. And it's going to happen again, and it needs to change. We need to cut through that.
And it looks like, Ahmed, that those opponents of Jeremy Corbyn won't relent until and unless he's gone.
Yeah, and it's not just about Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is 71 years of age. It's about anyone that claims to be on the left who wants to then become the Labour leader, and basically discouraging them from doing that, and also making sure that the Labour Party never allows somebody of Jeremy Corbyn's values or principles to lead their party, never to threaten the foreign policy interests such as the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which Britain arms to the teeth the Saudi coalition. We've got a tweet from Chris Williamson, who was one of the victims of this anti-Semitic witch hunt. He says, "No, no, no, thousand times no. Jeremy Corbyn has done nothing to apologise for. Members of the socialist camp should be given their unqualified solidarity to him. That's what socialists do. The people that deserve an apology are all the victims of this five-year-long witch hunt."
And finally, witch hunt, Ahmed Williamson says, shall we move on to your second story, if we may? The other story that we have been keeping track of, the French President Emmanuel Macron asking Muslim leaders in France to agree to a charter of Republican values as part of a broad clampdown on what he calls radical Islam. What's the latest development in that story?
Yes, so there are 5.7 million Muslims in France, and many are arguing that Emmanuel Macron and his whole cabinet are declaring war on those 5.7 million Muslims and their leaders, and are asking them to obey, to bow down, to distance themselves from their religion. And this charter is another example of that. So they have asked the leaders of the French Council of Muslim Faith to sign up to this charter, which distance Islam from any politics, but distance Islam from political Islam. But the problem with this charter and what he's asking these Muslim leaders to do is, in its very essence, it's political. He's politicizing the religion of Islam by pushing through policies, by supporting offensive cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He's the one that's politicizing our religion. And many are saying that Muslim leaders should not be signing up to any ultimatum like this. And it's time for the 5.7 million Muslims to unite and stand up against this Islamophobic agenda.
Share some of those views, Ahmed, people who have been calling on Muslims to take that course of action.
So Philippe says this: Macron is losing the French culture war on Islam in the foreign media. They are slowly coming to terms with the fact that there is no liberal but authoritarian conservative. Political liberalism and Islamophobia are not compatible. Final tweet on this one, we'll move on. Ali says, fascist, racist France now threatens to deport foreign parents who complain about their children being shown the Prophet Muhammad cartoons in the classroom. Quote, it will be a criminal offence, says Macron's anti-Islam, anti-Muslim interior minister. Islamophobia, racism, crusaders. Now, it's an atmosphere of hostility, and France's 5.7 million Muslims certainly feel under attack when interior minister is threatening to deport them if they dare voice their concern or offence.
All right, Ahmed Caballo with those stories. Ahmed, thanks for that. And moving on now, Russia's defense ministry says a Russian peacekeeper has been wounded and an Azerbaijani soldier killed in a mine explosion in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The blast happened hours after the Russian defense ministry announced it had deployed more than 100 mine-clearing experts to the region. Moscow has also sent over 2,000 peacekeepers to the enclave following the November 10 ceasefire agreement, which ended weeks of bloody conflict between Armenian and Azeri forces. The United Nations says undetonated landmines near Nagorno-Karabakh have killed more than 100 people since the 1990s. Pope Francis has met a delegation of NBA basketball players and discussed the role of sports in promoting social harmony.
Looking at the problems in society, and especially those of social justice, sport can be a good means of resolving them. And we should always remember this, because your message is the goodwill of sports, but also working together as a team, the work as a community, and may this be the seed of beauty and of a shared development towards justice.
Discussions surrounding race and discrimination in the United States were also part of the meeting. The European Union may be on the verge of releasing billions of euros to help economies within the bloc hit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. But a row over the EU's future budget and recovery plan is threatening to delay the release and sabotage its recovery. The introduction of a new mechanism that'll cut off EU funds to countries that violate the rule of law has ruffled feathers, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
The EU's economy is likely to shrink in the last 3 months of the year in a double-dip recession if the EU's 2021 to 2027 budget and the COVID-19 recovery plan, worth a combined 1.8 trillion euros, are not agreed upon. On Monday, Poland and Hungary vetoed both. They claim the mechanism linking future transfers of money to the issue of the rule of law is part of an unfair ideological battle being waged by Brussels.
We say a resounding no to all the mechanisms that punish us like naughty children, which treat Poland and other member states of the European Union unequally.
Hungarian Premier Viktor Orban called the conditionality plan a form of blackmail against member states opposed to immigration. Both countries are under EU investigation for undermining the independence of courts, media and non-governmental organizations. And with the condition in place, they risk losing access to tens of billions of euros. And despite fears that imposing new conditions for funding could eventually lead to a breakup of the European Union, the Netherlands and the European Parliament, among others, refused to accept the budget and rescue package without them. Nonetheless, the German EU presidency is optimistic about finding a solution within days.
We are in the last phase of negotiations. It is not easy, as we all know. But we will find a solution, and I am absolutely certain that we will be able to take decisions in the next couple of days for the EU budget, as well as for the recovery fund, so we are able to release the money. There are countries which are so severely hit by this crisis and which urgently need these means.
Amid all the EU's pressing concerns, getting a Brexit deal done and dusted looms large. The European Union's Brexit negotiator says big differences persist in Brexit trade talks with Britain, but both sides are pushing hard for a deal. Several European leaders are urging the Commission to begin putting contingency measures in place, though, in case a deal is not reached before the transition period ends on December 31st. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And two more stories that have crossed our radar today. The U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has unveiled a slate of names for cabinet posts in his administration, including the first woman to lead the U.S. intelligence community and first Latino to take charge of the Department of Homeland Security. But they're not our focus today. We're zooming in on his pick for Secretary of State. And I will hand you over to Robert Enlikesh to tell us who Tony Blinken is.
Well, Tony Blinken basically is a neoliberal war hawk, and he will replace a neoconservative war hawk in Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State. Many people have celebrated Joe Biden coming into power, somehow painting him as someone that's more rational and is going to bring in better people in the administration who will perhaps even, you know, limit the amount of war that the United States is engaging in. But we see with Tony Blinken that He is somebody that is an internationalist, and in that view, that worldview that he holds, he sees Israel as a key player that they have to be backing unequivocally, and that they need to continue to back against the Palestinians and everyone else in the region in order to have control in the Middle East. He's someone who supported the Iraq war. He's somebody who supported the war against Libya, which overthrew Gaddafi and turned Libya into a failed state. He's somebody that supports pretty much every war you could think of, the bombardments of Gaza, and has unequivocally stood with Israel, of course, will stand by side of Saudi Arabia and has supported the war on Yemen, the genocide which is going on there. So somebody that's not really a big change from Mike Pompeo, maybe not as aggressive when it comes to the JCPOA, but other than that, I mean, this guy is somebody that for the Middle East and South America is absolutely the same as Mike Pompeo, and he may prove, if he's allowed to go to war, he may prove to be even worse.
Right, and what kind of noises people have been making about these nominations, including his?
The first one we have here commenting on this is from a journalist in the United States called Ben Norton. He says, Biden's Secretary of State nominee is now official, liberal war hawk Tony Blinken. He supported the 2011 war that destroyed Libya and unleashed slave markets, defended Israel's massacres in Gaza, started the catastrophic war on Yemen, is a neoliberal at a private equity firm. And we've got another one here as well from a Twitter user called Zach, who says, yes, Bush and his war criminal buddies funding a super PAC for Biden has no implication or effect on who he picks for his cabinet.
All right, let's move on to your other story, Robert. This three-way, not-so-secret meeting between Netanyahu, MBS, and Pompeo.
Absolutely. This is a quite complex picture that we're looking at here, really, because, of course, this the information was leaked from the Israeli government, and the newspaper Haaretz confirmed, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz confirmed that a flight had been taken from Israeli territory into Saudi Arabia. However, this meeting was not supposed to be an official meeting, and talks were underway, reportedly, about normalization between Saudi Arabia and the Israeli regime. However, they didn't really go to plan. Netanyahu is looking for a political victory over his rival, Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz wasn't even informed about this. And then on top of that, now Saudi Arabia came out and said that this never happened, just completely denying reality, because at this stage, they're not looking to normalize officially. And their statement the day before, of course, affirmed that they would want a Palestinian state first before they would go ahead with normalization. So it actually hurts Saudi Arabia, this coming out, because it shows that under the table, they have actually normalized. And Netanyahu is just trying to win a political victory as he's in a terrible spot and his support is dwindling.
Although this came from the education minister, a member of his own cabinet, they have neither confirmed nor denied it, just like they haven't their nuclear program. Robert, what have people been saying about this whole thing?
The first tweet we pulled up here is from Marwa Osman, who says, Zionist MBS, no gray areas. Either you stand with Palestine or you don't. Either you stand with Yemen or you don't. Either you accept this traitor's warmongering and genocidal ways along his buddy terrorist Netanyahu, or you don't. No gray areas. And then we have another one here who says, they only have 58 days left to destroy Iran. A failure so far, also a failed normalization attempt.
A failed normalization attempt. All right. Thank you very much, Robert and Lakesh, with those stories and great analysis as always. And thank you. We'll see you again soon.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will nominate the veteran diplomat Antony Blinken as his Secretary of State and Linda Thomas-Greenfield as ambassador to the United Nations, moving forward to implement a campaign pledge. Blinken and Thomas-Greenfield bring deep foreign policy backgrounds to the nascent administration while providing a sharp contrast with Donald Trump, who distrusted such experience and embraced an America First policy that strained long-standing U.S. relationships. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Joe Biden to Nominate Antony Blinken as U.S. Secretary of State. Please stay with us for more of Julian Borger's article. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will nominate the veteran diplomat Antony Blinken as his Secretary of State and Linda Thomas-Greenfield as ambassador to the United Nations, moving forward to implement a campaign pledge. Antony Blinken and Linda Thomas-Greenfield bring deep foreign policy backgrounds to the nascent administration while providing a sharp contrast with Donald Trump, who distrusted such experience and embraced an America First policy that strained long-standing U.S. relationships. Blinken could be named as early as next Tuesday, according to sources close to Joe Biden, whilst the Axios website first reported Linda Thomas-Greenfield's impending nomination. Blinken's appointment made another longtime Biden aide and foreign policy veteran, Jake Sullivan, the top candidate to be U.S. National Security Advisor, according to a source who told the Reuters news agency. During the campaign, Joe Biden severely criticized Donald Trump's go-it-alone foreign policy and pledged to recommit to NATO and to other global pacts, whilst promising to tap experts to fight the COVID-19 crisis and other problems at home. He has promised to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and the World Health Organization, WHO, and potentially the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. America First has made America alone, Joe Biden said in a town hall meeting in October. Antony Blinken is a longtime Biden confidant who served as number two at the State Department and as Deputy National Security Advisor in Barack Obama's administration, in which Joe Biden served as Vice President. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, a black woman who served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa under Barack Obama, was intended to restore morale and help fulfill Joe Biden's pledge to choose a diverse cabinet, the Axios website reported. Jake Sullivan served as Joe Biden's National Security Advisor during the Obama administration and also as Deputy Chief of Staff to the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Ron Klain, Joe Biden's choice as White House Chief of Staff, told ABC's This Week program that the first Biden cabinet picks would come on Tuesday. Joe Biden said last week he had settled on a Treasury Secretary, the former Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen is believed to be the top candidate in Democratic and monetary policy circles. A spokesman for Joe Biden's transition team declined to comment. Ron Klain again urged that the Trump administration, specifically a federal agency called the General Services Administration, GSA, formally recognize Biden's victory in order to unlock resources for the transition process, Joe Biden is due to take office on 20th of January. A record number of Americans rejected the Trump presidency, and since then, Donald Trump has been rejecting democracy, Ron Klein told This Week. Since Biden, a Democrat, was declared the winner of the election 2 weeks ago, Trump has launched a barrage of lawsuits and mounted a pressure campaign to try to prevent state officials from certifying their vote totals, suffering another emphatic legal setback on Saturday in Pennsylvania. Joe Biden received 6 million more votes nationwide than Donald Trump and prevailed 306 to 232 in the state-by-state electoral college system that determines the election's victor. Ron Klein said there would be scaled-down versions of the existing traditions for Biden's inauguration. Inauguration ceremonies and related events typically draw huge crowds to Washington. COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging in many parts of the country amid a pandemic that has killed more than 256,000 Americans. Critics of Donald Trump, including Democrats and some Republicans, have accused him of trying to undermine faith in the American electoral system and delegitimize Joe Biden's victory by promoting false claims of widespread voter fraud.
Around the World with Reporters.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week. by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down, because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects the COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment, and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parvez Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off, although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is, how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
As the European Council is set to convene in December to discuss the tensions with Turkey, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for dialogue, but warned the EU not to become a tool for enmities during escalating tensions over the Eastern Mediterranean. In his latest statement on Turkey-EU ties, Erdogan said Turkey sees its future in Europe and mentioned Turkey's post-pandemic plans to improve judicial infrastructure and strengthen the economy and other reforms.
Bugün de kendimizi...
We see ourselves as an inseparable part of Europe, with which we share 600 years of historical bond. We are calling on the EU to create a closer bond with us, to keep the promise of full membership with Turkey. We see ourselves in Europe, not anywhere else. We aim to build our future with Europe.
Observers, however, say Turkey does not stand any chance to become an EU member, despite all negotiations.
In my opinion, the EU does not see Turkey either as a partner or a possible member of the bloc. For the EU, Turkey is only a trade ally. This means that neither now or in future, Turkey will not get closer to becoming an EU member.
Earlier this week, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said Turkey isn't sending positive signals and needs to change its attitude fundamentally regarding the hydrocarbon dispute with EU members Greece and Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. European leaders say they will watch for Turkey's steps in the next couple of weeks before discussing any potential sanctions in their upcoming summit. Turkey is still a candidate to become an EU member. The bloc decided to effectively freeze accession talks in June 2018 over disagreements on accession terms. Many here are pessimistic about the future of accession talks, despite Ankara's ongoing efforts to meet the EU's demands. Meanwhile, some economists even warn that the accession could harm Turkey's economy. Prashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian group say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation and that resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine.
Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world.
This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. A lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
According to many independent institutions like Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, some Australian troops have committed crimes against humanity, such as intentionally killing civilians, since the beginning of America's longest war in Afghanistan back in 2001. A recent report on Australian forces' potential war crimes in Afghanistan has provoked reactions from Afghan institutions. Afghanistan's Human Rights Commission has condemned the killing of civilians by Australian troops and urged the prosecution of those responsible for the crimes. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has dismissed as an inhuman move the killing of dozens of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Unfortunately, Australian forces have brutally killed civilians, including men, women and children in Uruzgan province. In fact, it proves that the lives of the Afghan women, men and children have no human value or dignity for them. Unfortunately, 39 civilians were killed by Australian forces during their 11 years' presence in Afghanistan.
This comes as experts believe there is not much optimism that independent investigations would be launched, even at the International Criminal Court, into the case of killing of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Although grounds are available to probe the case by the International Criminal Court, interference and pressure by certain powers have created serious obstacles in the way of launching investigations into war crimes in Afghanistan.
Based on a recent report released by the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, more than 32,000 civilians were killed and around 60,000 others, including women and children, were injured over the last decade. That is why the UN body also believes it's time to put an end to this human tragedy and misery by struggling to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties, and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public. As the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years, and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban-rural, coastal-inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us-versus-them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
Right. I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression-era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you'll get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries A.H., corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries A.D. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries A.H. were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Saadi, and Hafez lived in that era. During the Mongol invasion, some regions in Iran remained intact against the pillage and destruction imposed by the invaders. This was mainly due to the wisdom of the local rulers. For instance, Fars region remained safe because it was under the rule of Sa'd ibn Zangi, Abu Bakr, and his sons. They were Solgori rulers who used to consort with the men of letters and were sponsors of artists and poets. Thus, the rule in the region coincided with thriving of knowledge and literature. Therefore, when Genghis Khan and Hulagu attacked the region, the entire region remained safe and secure, and as a safe haven, attracted a group of notables of the era as well. The acclaimed poet Saadi Shirazi has composed poems on the situation of the region in those days. Shams Qais Razi, too, has explained his wandering in Khorasan and Iraq and asking the help of the great figures of Fars. He explains in details the efforts of Sa'debne Zangi's son for development and security of the region and the welfare of the people. The words of Shams Qais do show that the Fars region and the ports and islands of the Persian Gulf would be examples of development, security, and flourishing during the Sulguri rule.